To show its goodwill to find a peaceful solution to the years-long crisis in Yemen, Yemen's Ansarullah has put forward a new initiative with 9 points to tackle the current crisis.
The initiative put forward by the Ansarullah leader serves the interests of all Yemeni people. I believe it is an appropriate opportunity for all conflicting sides to get out of the current predicament and avoid military battles. With this initiative, Ansarullah reaffirms once again that it is keen on finding a political solution to the conflicts in Yemen.
The spokesman of Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, said the initiative includes stopping the Yemeni army's operations in Marib, reactivating the Marib gas station to generate electricity for all Yemen, and forming a joint administration from the people of Marib to maintain security and expel the terrorist groups from the city.
The initiative launched by Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi is aimed to stop war in Marib. The people of Marib should have the final say when it comes to their political fate. Meanwhile, the roads must be open for the free movement of Yemenis. This initiative is an appropriate measure that will benefit the Yemeni people and establish a comprehensive political and economic solution to the current crisis.
The free movement of all Yemenis, Abdul Salam said, should be guaranteed, as well as the release of all the detainees from the prisons of the Saudi-backed forces in Marib. Ansarullah's initiative came in conjunction with the UN's appointment of Hans Grundberg of Sweden as its new envoy for Yemen.
Many here say changing the UN envoy will not solve the problem because, as things stand, this is the US which controls the situation and leads the war on Yemen behind the scene. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hundreds of thousands of local Afghans have fled their cities and villages in northern and northeastern provinces due to back-to-back collapse of most provincial capitals in the north and northeast to Taliban. Some displaced families have arrived in the capital, Kabul, and they have nowhere to go but the roadside or parks like the one here in central Kabul. That is why they welcome any move that could mitigate their misery. The advances have displaced more families across the country. Some displaced people accuse local officials of making secret deals with Taliban.
Our city fell to Taliban without any exchange of fire. The same story went on in Ghazni city, where its governor was arrested by the NDS over handing over the city to Taliban. This proves that there are some secret deals behind the collapse of our cities.
The displaced Afghans urge warring sides to stop turning more cities into the battlefields by resuming a meaningful intra-Afghan negotiation.
We, the people of Afghanistan, are the main victims of war. We have lost all we had. Ceasefire is the only way to get out of the current crisis. The government and Taliban must sit for talks and resume a meaningful negotiation.
Afghan government has ordered the country's Ministry of Awqaf and Hajj to open the doors of all mosques in government-controlled areas for displaced families, and that the government is going to fully support them under close cooperation with the international humanitarian agencies. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyatullah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Neuron developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Neuron will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine, dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, has blasted the decision to hold joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in South Korea this month. Her statement, read on official media, also called for the removal of U.S. troops and weapons from the Korean Peninsula.
The U.S. is determinedly pushing forward with these aggressive war drills when international attention is focused on the development of the situation on the Korean Peninsula. It is indeed the chief architect destroying peace and stability in the region. And this also proves that diplomatic engagement and dialogue with no strings attached touted by the present U.S. administration is hypocrisy to cover up its aggressive nature.
The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has reached out for, quote, unconditional talks with Pyongyang. Although U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over North Korea's nuclear weapons program remain in place, experts consider North Korea's perspective.
The most important thing is the content of the joint exercises. Officially, they are described as defensive in nature, but if you look closely, they employ very offensive strategies, preemptively striking North Korea, removing state leadership, and capturing North Korean territory. It's threatening from the North Korean standpoint.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in had been trying to generate peace with North Korea, but Seoul's close alliance with Washington and purchase of major U.S. weapons has hindered his efforts toward Pyongyang. The decision to go ahead with the joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises has already impacted inter-Korean relations. In late July, hotline communications between the two Koreas were restored after being severed for more than a year. However, since the announcement of the drills, North Korea is no longer answering South Korea's calls. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After 5 years of the closure imposed on Sana'a International Airport by Saudi Arabia, Yemenis held a protest inside the airport to renew their demands and call for its reopening. Protesters chanted slogans urging the international community to push Riyadh to remove its merciless blockade on Yemen.
The closure of Sana'a International Airport has caused a major humanitarian crisis and it is a war crime. Yemenis are not trapped and considered hostages. The Ministry of Health statistics confirmed that more than 95,000 patients have died because they were unable to travel for treatment, and 480,000 patients urgently need to travel and their fate is unknown amid the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. There are also 4 million expatriates who want to return, but the airport closure prevented them.
The repercussions of the Saudi violation of international covenant on civil and political rights and closing Sana'a International Airport are getting worse, especially to those with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and liver, who hope to travel abroad for proper medical treatment, but unfortunately it seems impossible, at least for a while.
5 years since the closure of Sana'a Airport, which is not a short period, it has caused an exacerbation of human suffering because the airport is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis. Before the war, 6,000 passengers, including 100 patients, used to leave every day from Sana'a Airport. More than 30 patients die every day due to the restrictions on the airport. There are more than 70,000 cancer patients and 20,000 kidney failure patients who need to travel for treatment amid the collapse of the healthcare system due to the fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detention of Yemeni oil ships.
At the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen besides its war, resulting in the closure of Sana'a International Airport to all flights and trapping millions of Yemenis, including patients, in a war zone. However, Sana'a Airport still receives the United Nations flights alone on a daily basis.
Thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, have died while waiting for a chance to travel through this airport. People here say the Saudi blockade goes against international law and its requirement that everyone should be free to leave any country, including their own. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The continuing fallout over Britain's Prince Andrew's friendship with the deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. A lawsuit brought against the Duke by mother of three, Virginia Giuffre, who alleges she was trafficked to the prince by Epstein and his co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, when she was 17 and forced to sleep with him on three occasions. In a statement later, Giuffre said the powerful and rich are not exempt from being held responsible for their actions. I hope that other victims will see that it is possible not to live in silence and fear, but to reclaim one's life by speaking out and demanding justice. But the Queen's son denies any wrongdoing.
Things only started snowballing after that infamous interview. The humiliated royal was evicted from his private office in the building behind me at his mother's orders. After that, the slew of companies and institutions that severed all ties with him.
66-year-old Epstein is said to have committed suicide in a U.S. jail in 2019, a month after he was arrested over sex trafficking charges. His partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, has pleaded not guilty to those charges and is awaiting trial in November. It is yet to be seen how the Duke or the beleaguered British royal family will emerge from this new looming storm. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years, while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced a national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits, and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us, as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sours relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Iran has condemned the remarks by European Union officials on the recent attack against an Israeli-owned tanker as irresponsible. Speaking at his online weekly press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh rejected the accusations as baseless, saying blaming Iran is a scenario planned by the Israeli regime and that the comments by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region.
Such remarks by EU officials do not contribute to the peace and stability of the region. Tehran has summoned the British and Romanian envoys in Tehran to register protest against the baseless allegations. The fact that Britain has sided with the rebellious and notorious Zionist regime shows the position of this country.
In reaction to a statement released by the G7 against Tehran, the official said the country will not remain silent in the face of the security of its commercial vessels. He further noted that the security of the Persian Gulf is Iran's red line and that the country has always tried to keep this waterway safe from insecurities created by such countries as UK.
Iran is concerned about the obvious violation that the UK did against an Iranian oil tanker in international waters in July 2019. But the security of the Persian Gulf is the red line for Iran. Tehran has done its best to protect the waterway from insecurities orchestrated by countries like the UK. We advise the British government to pay attention to its own responsibilities and duties.
Tension has been escalating in the region in recent weeks against the backdrop of a suspected drone attack last week that targeted an Israeli managed tanker, Mercer Street, off the Omani coast. The regime in Tel Aviv and its Western allies, the UK and the US, accuse Iran of orchestrating the attack. Iran has vehemently rejected the charges as baseless and childish. Moreover, Tel Aviv said it is ready to strike Iran in retaliation for the attack. But Iran has already warned of a crushing response to any such move.
Iran describes as suspicious a number of reported security incidents in the Persian Gulf region and has warned against any effort to create a vicious atmosphere to pursue certain political goals. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The Taliban are pressing ahead with their offensive across Afghanistan, capturing Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand province, in the south, as they've taken half of the country's 34 provincial capitals in recent days. The second and third largest cities, Herat and Kandahar, were also captured on Thursday. More than two-thirds of the country is now under the control of the militants, who are tightening the noose around the capital, Kabul. UN agencies have warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan amid the violence that has escalated the suffering of millions in the war-torn countries. Thousands are fleeing from the capital, fleeing from areas to the capital, Kabul, in search of shelter. Our correspondent, Amin Alami, is joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Amin, talk to us about the significance of the recent Taliban gains, and also the UN has mentioned that a humanitarian catastrophe is on the rise.
Well, Badia, the Taliban are advancing rapidly all over Afghanistan. They have captured several provincial capitals over the past 24 hours. For instance, they are currently controlling 18 out of 34 provinces of Afghanistan. But the fact on the ground proves that the recent provinces were fallen into the hands of Taliban without any strong resistance by Afghan security forces. In some cases, local officials have handed over some provincial capitals to the Taliban, mainly in southern part of this country and northern areas. Ghazni city, the capital of Ghazni province in southern Afghanistan, was handed over to Taliban by Dawood Laghwani, the governor of this province. Later on the day, when he was heading to the capital, Kabul, via Kabul-Herat highway, he was arrested by Afghan security forces in Maidan Shah, the capital of Maidan Wardak province, in central, very close to Kabul. In the meantime, the Taliban also captured the capital of Logar province, that is the city of Puli Alam. However, the intense fightings are also underway in most areas of Kunar province in eastern Afghanistan, as well as in Laghman and Nangarhar provinces, again in eastern Afghanistan. This comes as some top political leaders in Afghanistan, especially in northern part of this country, are still insisting on resisting against the Taliban militant group. For instance, Atta Mohammed Nur, the prominent political leader in northern Afghanistan, as well as the Marshal Abdurrashid Dostum, recently declared their commitment to strongly resist against the Taliban militants. in case they continue to further launch attacks on the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, the capital of northern Balkh province. Marshal Dostum named this strategic province in northern Afghanistan, I mean Balkh province, as the entrance gate of Afghanistan. And he said that under the strong support receiving from locals, we will successfully defeat the Taliban not only in Balkh province, but also across the entire northern Afghanistan, and then across the all provinces of Afghanistan. This comes as top U.S. officials has also asked President Ghani to resign. The demand has so far been not rejected or confirmed by the Afghan presidential here in Kabul so far.
All right, thanks a lot. Amin Press TV's Amin Alimi joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have our guest, senior analyst, foreign policy and focus, Ian Williams, who is joining us from New York. And research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, who's with us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Ian Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, what do you make of this offensive? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government? All right, unfortunately, we're experiencing some technical difficulties with Mr. Williams in New York. Mr. Williams, stay with us as we get that sorted out. I'm going to address that same question to Mr. Samueli in Budapest. Mr. Samueli, what do you make of the Taliban offensive, the recent gains that they've made so rapidly? Why did everything unravel so fast for the Afghan government?
Well, I think it's unraveled very fast because of complete demoralization and incompetence on the part of the Afghan government. I mean, there are two separate issues here, which is the situation for the United States, and then there's a situation for the Taliban. So without question, this has been a profound humiliation for the United States. I mean, they've been fighting against the Taliban for 20 years, and then they announced that they're going to withdraw, and the whole edifice that they've created over 20 years just seems to collapse, really, within a matter of days. So that is, without question, a debacle. The other question, I think, is that will the Taliban ultimately prevail? And that I think, is far from certain. I mean, if we looked at Afghan history, I mean, there's always a pattern whereby somebody is on the offensive, it seems that the opposition melts away, then the victorious army marches into Kabul, takes over, and then the opposition just regroups in the countryside, in the mountains, and then it in turn starts resisting against the ruling groups. So we had this, remember, back the Soviets who took over Kabul in the late 1970s, and look where that got them. They immediately were facing enormous resistance in the countryside. Then eventually the pro-Soviet government collapsed, and then we had a civil war between the various Mujahideen factions that fought it out during the early 90s. The Taliban was triumphant in 1996, but they in turn were facing resistance from the Northern Alliance. And you remember in 2001, the Taliban melted away as the Afghan government is melting away. And they, of course, in turn then regrouped and mounted their own offensive. So this is a pattern in Afghanistan. It is a very difficult, complicated, diverse country to rule over. I mean, it's hard to even describe it as a country. I mean, it's a warlords, it's regions, it's religious differences, ethnic differences. You've got Uzbeks, Tajiks, Pashtuns. Very hard to rule it over. So I don't expect the Taliban to have a particularly easy time of ruling. And if they continue in this way, ignoring the entreaties of the international actors such as the United States and Russia and China, and just simply press ahead for victory, sure, they're going to end up in disaster just like they did in the period of 1996 to 2001, when they were diplomatically isolated. No one recognized them other than Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Pakistan, and thus they were very vulnerable to attack to the United States, and no one said boo when the Americans invaded.
Back to New York now, Mr. Williams. What does the current situation say about the U.S. presence in Afghanistan, about the $1 trillion spent, all the claims of propping up and equipping security forces in Afghanistan? Why aren't the security forces having any success against the Taliban right now?
As lots of people have pointed out, it's Vietnam all over again. The rosy reports from politically inspired generals to meet the politicians' demands in Washington to show that the taxpayers' money and the conscripts, their soldiers' lives were not being wasted. So the reports came out that were completely Panglossian. And remember, this is all of their own making. This is blowback to the maximum. They originally set up the Taliban with the help of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the others to fight the Soviets. So it was blowback. They came back and bit them. And the same thing is happening, still happening now. Remember, it's a U.S. ally funded, with the military funded and trained by the U.S., Pakistan, which has been covertly helping the Taliban all of this time. It's a very murky situation in which nobody really seems to care about the Afghan people, which the Afghan people have noticed. They knew that the U.S. wasn't propping up the fight against the Taliban to protect them or to protect women's rights. It was in their geopolitical interest to do so, and it was in the interest of politicians back in Washington to pretend that they were fighting the good fight. So I agree that from now on, I think the Taliban have got some hard going, because they're hitting up against the rock. Dostum, the Uzbeks, the people in the north, the old Northern Alliance, they're ever heavily armed, loaded for bear. They've got no time for the Taliban, and they will fight back. And just all around the country, it's a heavily armed country. Everybody is heavily armed. The Taliban have shown no sign of catering to popular opinion. And not just with the alienating women, intellectuals, lots of other people. They're going to be every bit as arrogant as the Americans, with the only distinction that they look like the locals, and which the Americans never managed to do, even when they wore the strange Afghan hats. So it's a mess of America's making. They came into Afghanistan allegedly with a UN backing, we should remember, because of the 9/11 incident. But immediately that was hijacked by those politicians in Washington and diverted into a crusade against Iraq, rightly or wrongly, most of us think. But they went into Iraq. That's where they put all their forces. And they left Afghanistan on the back burner. They didn't pursue the victory, the military victory that they'd had. They didn't really pursue the nation building. They made it very plain. They treated the local politicians with disdain.
Right.
I mean, just think, a year or so ago, they started negotiations with the Taliban without even telling the politicians in Kabul. How is that for showing your disdain and contempt? How do you expect Afghans to go and fight for die and to fight and die in a war where the Americans are going to sign off on it without telling them what's happening?
Okay, let's go cross over to Mr. Samuel Lee. Mr. Williams brought up an interesting point. That's the negotiations that started around last year in Doha. Those negotiations, I believe, are still taking place there. What relevance do they have now at this point? What are the objectives and goals of such talks at a time when the country is being overrun by the Taliban?
Well, that's a very good question. Now, of course, they should be of relevance, because if the Taliban doesn't want to end up as disastrously as they ended up from 1996 to 2001, then they should engage in some kind of negotiations under international auspices to set up a coalition government, a multi-party government, you know, all the factions in Afghanistan, and try to rule as part of a coalition. If, as is likely, the Taliban isn't going to do it, if it is likely that they're just going to press ahead for victory, then I think they're heading for disaster, because it's already clear that its neighbors, the Central Asian countries, are very much now already aligning themselves with Russia. They're engaging in military preparations. Should there be any trouble coming from the Afghanistan, I think the Chinese are very wary that a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan will become another fount of Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, the Chinese are already very wary of the Muslim population in Xinjiang and concerned, you know, what the impact of the Taliban would be then. So if they just press ahead for victory, I think they're going to find themselves isolated and probably subject to all manner of subversion from its neighbors, who have every incentive of making life as difficult as possible for the Taliban. So they'll be sponsoring Northern Alliance and various indigenous insurgencies against the Taliban. So, you know, if they're intelligent, then they would take these Doha talks seriously. I suspect they're not, and they're going to head for the same disaster they ended up in 2001.
Ian Williams, will a Taliban rule Afghanistan in 2021? Will it resemble the previous time that they were in power in the 90s? What will Afghan life be like in the areas under Taliban rule?
I suspect it's going to be horrifying for, you know, for women, for anybody who's independent-minded. These people don't want to be in a coalition. They could have been in a coalition any time. They could have been part of a coalition government. They've been offered that for the last 10 years or more. No problem. They don't want a coalition. They're getting their orders from God, and they're not going to take them from anybody else. They're not going to accept mediation. So they're going to carry on behaving frightfully. All the signs are, wherever they've gone in, they've engaged in retaliatory shootings and executions. They're going to carry on with the same theological agenda, and they're going to alienate the people. And this time, of course, they're weakened because the infidel are out of the equation. The one claim to legitimacy that they had was that the infidel US was on the Afghan territory, on Muslim territory. That's no longer the case. They've removed their own sort of best ideological ally in that sense. From now on, it's going to be them versus the co-religionists and their co-nationalists and the neighbors as well. You know, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, they're all there, you know, nominally Muslim, and they are not going to tolerate any incursions from across the border. And the Taliban will almost certainly do that, and then they'll get whacked.
George Samueli, what will the Taliban run Afghanistan mean for the presence of groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh? Of course, we have to mention the Haqqani Network, which was an Al-Qaeda affiliate that has fought shoulder to shoulder with the Taliban.
Yes, well, that's the one commitment that they made when the Trump administration signed their original Doha agreement, which was that they would not allow Afghanistan to once again become a center for Al-Qaeda, for any international terrorist group. I don't take that very seriously. I mean, they've adhered to it so far. Al-Qaeda hasn't yet returned. It's quite likely that, Al-Qaeda, various Islamic fundamentalist groups will return. And again, if that happens, then the Taliban will be very vulnerable to its neighbors. So you've got, Iran, you've got Russia, you've got China, you've got the Central Asians, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, all of whom are very, very anxious about Afghanistan becoming once again a center of Islamic fundamentalism. I mean, this is a long-standing concern of its neighbors, and the Taliban has done very little to reassure its neighbors that it has learned its lessons and it will never again become the center of international terrorism. So I do think that it is quite likely that all of the Al-Qaeda types are going to be back, and disaster beckons for Afghanistan, sadly.
Ian Williams, what about Pakistan, a main variable in Afghanistan's Taliban saga? Where do you see Pakistan in this equation?
Well, It's not just Pakistan, it's also Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. The US has never dealt with them. The US has still not dealt with the Saudi role in the original 9/11. It closed its eyes for geopolitical reasons. It closed its eyes all these years to Pakistan. I mean, there was Pakistan hosting the leader of Al-Qaeda in one of its big garrison towns, and nobody knew. Well, you know, there might be non-halal, but pigs were flying all the way through Pakistan when that was happening. And they took no notice whatsoever. And the US took no notice, because they were playing Pakistan for other geopolitical reasons. They have never had a connected, joined-up foreign policy in Washington. They've appeased Pakistan when it's suited. They appease Saudi Arabia. Do you think those elements in Saudi Arabia really love the Americans and the Israelis? They're waiting there for their time to come back for more. And they will provide the resources for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and whoever. And the U.S. hasn't done anything about the source, so it can't complain when it flows down onto them. And it really is a mess of Washington's own making almost all the way through, which is bad. It'd be good to have what the Germans call Schadenfreude, joy at other people's discomfort, but the Afghan people are going to suffer from this. They are suffering from it. They suffered just as they suffered when the US originally got the Taliban in there. You know, this was on the way to becoming a sort of fairly progressive secular democracy up to a point. You know, women engineers, women pilots, etc., all cast back to the Middle Ages with U.S. support and arming. That was the situation when blowback was on. That was the situation that set it for the blowback of Al-Qaeda and 9/11. Now it's deja vu all over again, as the famous American philosopher said.
And very briefly, if you may, Mr. Samueli, give us your thoughts on where Pakistan falls into all of this.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that Pakistan has been playing a very two-faced game in all of this. It's pretended to be supporting the United States' global war on terror, whereas, of course, all along it has seen the Taliban as its instrument. It was a mechanism for the Pakistan to dominate Afghanistan. And as your other guest pointed out, the fact was that Bin Laden, and I believe it was to get Bin Laden that the United States invaded Afghanistan. Bin Laden made his home in Pakistan. I mean, it's ridiculous to try to argue that the Pakistanis did not know that Bin Laden was peacefully living in its country. So they knew he was living there, and they left him alone. They, you know, let him go on living there in comfort. They never notified the United States he is here. And in fact, the Pakistanis were very indignant about the U.S. raid that actually eventually killed Bin Laden. Hey, you know, our sovereignty has been violated. So yeah, I mean, Pakistan has been playing a two-faced game. The United States has known that it's playing a two-faced game, just as the United States has known for decades that Saudi Arabia plays a two-faced game, pretending to be a supporter of the global war on terror while actually financing these terrorist groups all over the world.
Well, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Thank you, gentlemen. Senior analyst at Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, joining us from New York. Also, thanks to Research Fellow Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. And also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
the abduction of indigenous children was a project meant to render their worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. This is perhaps why the Israeli regime military targets children. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Benny Bland Ryder. This article is published under the heading, From Boarding Schools to Child Detention, Lives of Children Matter. Stay tuned for the details. Yes, I am thinking of Palestinian children and undocumented children as well, mused Dean activist Melissa Tessot. They are literally being killed daily by these settler governments. As an essential part of her culture, running helps to process things. And so she did the 2.15 run in memory of 215 indigenous children who were found in a mass grave at Kamloops Residential School in Canada. On May 29, 2021, Al Jazeera reported that the remains of more than 200 indigenous children, some as young as 3, have been found at the site of a former residential school in western province of British Columbia. To our knowledge, these missing children are undocumented deaths. The Columbus Toskumpe First Nation Chief Rosanne Casimir explained. They are among the many victims of mental and sexual abuse, neglect, and other forms of violence over a period of 100 years during which church-supported boarding schools operated across Canada. By forcibly taking children from their families, the schools sought to break Indigenous family and cultural ties in order to assimilate children into white Canadian society. According to Muskawis Voices, co-founder of Bear Clan Patrol, Calgary, and chairman of MIM Social Justice Committee, approximately 6,000 Native children died in residential schools from disease. Beatings, firing squads, malnutrition, and electrocution, among other forms of torture and neglect. The residential schools took the children from the land. Voices continues, adding, to disconnect people from their culture in order to take the land from children. Moreover, this form of genocide, he says, is ongoing as children are still removed from their ancestral lineages. One of the worst and most powerful things on this earth is the look in a mother's eyes and the pain she experiences when she has that which she loves most in this world taken away from her. Because the violence is ongoing, so is the trauma, mental scars that are generational in nature, in that they are passed down from parents to children in a never-ending cycle of pain. Nevertheless, what happened to the children at Kamloops Residential School, writes Adel Skander, assistant professor of global communication at Simon Fraser University, is neither unique nor surprising. Like settler colonial projects everywhere, including the Americas and Palestine, its objectives, he continues, were always a combination of land appropriation, resource extraction, and demographic engineering. The abduction of indigenous children, he concludes, was a project meant to render the worlds unsalvageable, create new realities on the ground, demoralize them out of resistance. Given this framework, it makes sense that the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestinian children would be much the same. Indeed, in the past few days, the Zionist regime has launched a massive arrest campaign against Palestinians who participated in recent uprisings against the colonial project. As Abir Kopti notes, Zionist regime police officers, border police, and secret service members are expected to arrest approximately 500 participants in peaceful protest. Among those arrested have been children, including Abdul Khaler and Mohammad Bornat, sons of Berlin activists by Ayad Bornat. In an interview with Robert Inlakish, Bornat chronicles the history of Israeli regime aggression that has for years been unleashed on his family. Earlier in May, Zionist forces murdered his nephew Islam, a 16-year-old boy who was participating in the protest. Since then, they have repeatedly invaded his house, along with other homes, wreaking havoc and arresting the children of other families. After they took Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad, my wife and my daughter don't sleep. The tears haven't left my wife's eye, said Iyad. My youngest son, Muhyiddin, he continues, Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad are now in Al-Mukbiya prison, a detention facility in West Al-Quds that Inlakish says has a reputation for using high-level forms of torture during interrogations. Indeed, Bernard reports that his lawyer, who communicated with Abdul Khaliq via computer screen, attests that the boy says he is being placed in what is known as a ghost chair for more than 15 hours a day in order to extract information that he does not have. According to Bernard, the ghost chair is small so that the hands and feet can be tightly tied to inflict a maximum amount of pain. These two boys are among the many children now in the Zionist regime jails. Palestinian journalist Zaina Halwani, recently arrested while covering protests in Sheikh Jarrah, documented her experience listening to Palestinian children screaming for their mothers during few nights that she spent in prison. In 1948, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion warned, "We must do everything to ensure Palestinians never do return." Indeed, he hoped that the old will die and the young will forget, ensuring that they would not return to their homes. This is perhaps why the Zionist regime military targets children like Abdul Khaliq and Muhammad. They want to begin breaking the resistance of the Palestinians when they are young, in hopes that they will leave their land. It was also the rationale behind forcibly taking indigenous children away from their family in order to send them to the now infamous boarding schools, thereby severing their connection with the land. Fortunately, for the indigenous in the Americas and in Palestine, that strategy has failed. This resistance demonstrates the spiritual relationship between indigenous peoples and their land, a connection that native people believe the pipeline will sever. Given both these examples, it is clear that colonial efforts to ethnically clear the land has completely failed. As Melissa Tassot concludes, it shouldn't take the findings of our people's remains to validate this horrible legacy of colonial regimes. Respect our humanity by respecting the results, the truth in history, and by supporting our struggle for liberation. Stop treating us the same way our kids got mistreated in residential and boarding. Stand up for indigenous rights always. The same should be said for Palestinian children too.
Fateful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.